Hello and welcome to the Granta Podcast. I'm Yuka Igarashi, and today I'm delighted to be joined by writer, journalist, and activist Rebecca Solnit. Solnit is the author of numerous books about art, landscape, ecology, and politics. They include A Paradise Built in Hell, A Field Guide to Getting Lost, Wanderlust, A History of Walking, Infinite City, a book of 22 maps with nearly 30 collaborators, and most recently, The Faraway Nearby, published this June. We discuss her new book and the way it manages to interweave personal narratives about family and illness with stories about Mary Shelley and Che Guevara. We also talk about her interest in paradoxes and her momentary connection to Beyoncé. It's very nice to have you here. Thank you so much for coming. So your new book, The Faraway Nearby, it's a beautiful book. And like much of your writing, I think it's very difficult to summarize. And I thought one thing we could do is to start by saying how you would like to summarize it, or how you explain it to people.
You know, I think even harder than A Field Guide to Getting Lost is this book, which is about many things which hang together perfectly but make me sound like a crazy lady with a shopping cart full of odds and ends if I tried to describe. Well, there's some Arctic in it, but Che Guevara is also there. But the easiest way to summarize what it's about is one summer, some years back, I suddenly received 100 pounds of apricots. And you could see the whole book as an inquiry into what that gift of apricots meant and where it all took me. The apricots were from my mother's tree. This summer, she no longer lived in her home because she's no longer able to live on her own. Mm-hmm. And of course, so the apricots were a gift. The gift was from my mother. The first chapter is about the apricots. The next is about my mother. And so it goes. The book is structured like Russian dolls. And I think of each chapter being inside the one before, which is why they repeat in reverse order at the end. So the first and last chapter is apricots, the second and second to last is mirrors, and so forth.
Right.
It's really a book about empathy and illness and storytelling, about the ways we separate ourselves from the people around us or connect to people next to us or far away, about the uses of distance and coldness and warmth and closeness, and the way we each navigate those, create a kind of personal map beyond our bodily boundaries of where we're connected and what we're passionate about and what we're oblivious and numb to.
That's a lot of things to cover in a book. One of the things that was interesting to me also is that here on the jacket of the book that I have here, it calls it a memoir and an anti-memoir. Is that your term?
It is, and I was very grateful Granta was willing and able to do that. We don't have that kind of, what would we call it, categorization on the American one, but I actually find it very helpful. You know, there's been this big surge of memoir, and there's ways in which it's wonderful. It's about the sense that everybody has a story. But what makes me crazy is that we've all learned how to tell that story from pop psychology and novels, the kind of mainstream novels, which give you a very coherent sense of self with predictable borders. And also what I think of as the privatized self, the self whose only dramas are really about family and romance and, you know, and not much more. And I'm restless, and I don't like being penned in. And a lot of my other work has been about what I would call the public self in contrast to the private self, the citizen, the person engaged with politics and struggles. You know, I've been around the Indian Wars and a lot of movements, and written in my book on disaster, A Paradise Built in Hell, about these beautiful efflorescences of civil society and disaster and revolution. But I also think that everybody's self is just much more nebulous, much more mysterious and contrary than you often get in memoir, where there's a very neat resolution, just like in a novel,
right,
where people seem to recall conversations from they heard when they were 5 years old with perfect recall. And there's a lack of doubt about one's own reliability, one's own memory. You know, it's modeled after the novel, and it gets very kind of reassuring, and I'm not sure reassuring is the goal of this book. I'm interested in the things that we don't know, the ways we're mysteries even to ourselves and the people around us are, the ways that the things you lose can be gifts as well, and the things we forget or can't never quite resolve. and in writing stories that don't get all tidied up at the end.
Yes, it does seem as if this book takes a lot of its energy from not closing down things, but sort of opening them up and sort of defying boundaries in the way that you've said.
Yeah, my early work was as an art critic, and there's a kind of criticism. I guess the way I could describe it is to say that I sometimes say museums love art the way taxidermists love deer. There was this desire to kind of bag it, stuff it, and mount it, or to triumph over it, to kind of wrestle it to the mat. And that was this a kind of writing which you find in other genres as well, that desires to have the last word, to be definitive and authoritative, and all these sort of macho objective things. And my goal as a critic, and then in everything I've written since, has been not to nail things down, but to open them up, to, you know, kind of trace the tangled threads of meaning and possibility, to make work that's an invitation for people to continue the journey on their own, or to apply the ideas I might explore, as I do in this book, through my own life, to their own life and their own adventures. So there's always a kind of gesture of opening up rather than closing down, or at least an intention of doing so.
Do you think that your interest in fairy tales has to do with this idea of openness? There's something you sort of equate this 100 pounds of apricots that you talk about in the beginning of the book to a sort of fairy tale, and also both a burden and a gift, like you said. And I think there's something about fairy tales that are also very open and perhaps a different type of narrative than your usual novel or your usual memoir.
You know, I love the writers who write fables. Among the contemporaries are Eduardo Galeano, and I guess Isaac Dinesen no longer counts as a contemporary, but her as well. And I love fairy tales for that concise fable-like way of telling things. They don't have to say, like, Cinderella was totally stressed out as she, you know, that it's the psychology's kind of, you can assume you know what it's like to be oppressed by a wicked stepmother, etc. So that conciseness fascinates me. Yeah. But really, for this book, fairy tales came up because 100 pounds of apricots is a fairy tale gift. You know, it was such a ridiculous abundance. It felt like those fairy tale, you know, the heaps of grain that you have to sort out overnight on pain of death, or the whole room full of straw you have to spin into gold with the same general time constraints and death penalty. But also like the fairy tale gifts that have a kind of magic about them. You know, it felt like this was at last my inheritance, my birthright, my great gift from my mother. But what did it really mean? It was like the five magic beans that will grow all the way up to the sky, the magic word that opens doors, the key to an unknown door. And so it wasn't just 100 pounds of fruit to sort through and throw out the rotten ones and can and preserve and freeze. It was a riddle or a question to be resolved, and that's also very much a fairy tale thing. Fairy tales are very much about, you know, kind of solving riddles and questions, and also about the power that comes not through autonomous strength, but through alliance, through friendships and favors returned, and alliances often of the powerless, since fairy tale protagonists are children and marginal people.
It's interesting that the ways that the themes of your work return again and again in different ways. I think that a lot of what you just said relates to books that you've written in the past, like you said, the book about Paradise Built in Hell, which is about disasters. And except this book seems a lot more personal and a lot more deeply personal. So was that different for you to write something that came from a story from your mother, as opposed to looking out into the world and seeing sort of patterns and political movements in that way?
It's very different. The writing histories, writing about other people, writing politically, is really like writing in the daytime. You can see pretty clearly, you know what you're doing, you don't bump into too much that's unexpected in that kind of way. Although meanings always reveal themselves, and there are always surprises, and the craft is always demanding. But writing something so personal like this is really writing in the dark. I had to write it to figure out what it means and rewrite it, and there were a lot of surprises for me in it. And then also, I don't quite know what it gives other people. When I wrote A Paradise Built in Hell, which is actually what I was writing while I went through all these difficulties, I knew what it meant for other people, because it's all pretty clear-cut if we actually behave much more altruistically and generously in disaster, if disasters become these moments when civil society is reborn and people find these connections that are suppressed by the other disaster of everyday life. But with this, you know, the book's just coming out, a number of people have said amazing things to me about how they read it. Amazing because they're positive in some cases, but also because they're surprising about how they read it, what it meant to them, how it might resonate with their own story. With this, you know, I don't quite know what I'm doing, which I think is a necessary way to go sometimes, to kind of explore deeper.
I do think that there is something in this book where you are able to tie this, you know, seamlessly sort of going from personal to the sort of more anecdotal and historical. One of my favorite chapters is one that you already mentioned, the Che Guevara chapter. And I don't know if you'd want to talk a little bit about how that chapter came together for you, or that section of the book.
Absolutely, yeah. And this is a way in which I think of the book as anti-memoir. We're often told that ourself is this sort of unified dramatic entity that's also very me, 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 the kind of stories we've learned to tell to therapists and psychoanalysts. But I think we live through other people and through the grand stories that organize our world about gender and race and culture and value and meaning that we all get from our culture, whether they're destructive or useful or somewhere in between. And then, you know, we spend our lives listening to other people's stories, which are also guideposts in conversation with people, reading and watching films and things like that. And so we literally spend a lot of our lives being other people in some sense, as listeners and watchers and readers. Mm. And I wanted to represent that, and that's one of the anti-memoirish things, because you really do live through those things. And for me, the apricots, the relationship with my mother, begat these deep questions about empathy, how we go numb to each other, how we connect to each other, what's dangerous about that, and where we fail, where we do reach out.
Yeah, one of the sort of wonderful things about that chapter is that it gave me a completely new understanding of leprosy as a disease. I think another theme that runs throughout the book is sort of illness and pain. And I think you sort of rewrote my understanding of what leprosy was, and it was usually understood as a disease where your limbs fall off, but actually it's a disease where you don't feel pain in your limbs, and that's why you sort of neglect them. And I thought that was an incredibly powerful metaphor that you've built.
It was, and that chapter structured as a Russian doll itself is my erstwhile boyfriend. While we're driving home, an old woman who'd actually known Che Guevara started talking about the Motorcycle Diaries, the book that was turned into a film. And the film played it very much as though Che and his friend Alberto Granada were these kind of Dharma bums just, you know, tripping across South America the way Kerouac and his friends went across North America. But they're really going from leprosy colony and hospital to leprosy colony and hospital. They intended to become specialists, and Granada was already working with leprosy sufferers in Argentina. I think they're attracted to it because this disease, you know, has been the most stigmatized, that these people were the most outcast. So to identify and connect and treat with empathy and intimacy these people was a kind of act of rebellion and generosity. But what my ex said that was so amazing was that exactly what you just said, that the damage most people with leprosy incur is not from the disease per se, it's because they're the disease destroys your nerves, and what you no longer feel, you can't take care of. You hold the cigarette till it burns your fingers. You wear the shoes till they wear holes in your feet. Mm. All the little adjustments we all make all the time about comfort don't get made, and that can happen to your eyes, to your hands, to your feet. And so you begin to get this really terrible damage. And that was so compelling for me, that we damage what we can't feel. And it spoke to something that was really a bigger question about how do we go numb to other people? How do we not feel these people that we're bombing, or these people living in the same house with us but that we abuse or neglect or just can't hear? How do we shut down? Because people with leprosy are often very kind and empathic and, as Alberto Granado said, grateful for the kindness shown to them. But the rest of us suffer other kinds of, you know, I'm sort of more metaphysical leprosy, where we go numb to the people around us or the people impacted by our actions. And that's, again, the kind of other coastline of the self I wanted to trace. That's not the simple biography or the self is everything within your skin, but these ways that you reach out into the world to become one with somebody in a sense and to feel what they feel or feel for them, or that you fail at that and don't feel when you should.
Yes, it started to become, to me, about this a collective body or sort of a societal body. And the metaphor was sort of a beautiful switch, and it happened kind of seamlessly, which was really incredible for me when I was reading it. And I guess one of the questions I also had was just how, as a writer, you are able to sort of construct these sorts of narratives that are so seamlessly moving from sort of the ways that we've said, from sort of the personal to the larger questions. Is that in terms of structure, how do you plan, or do you plan when you write?
I do, and there is, but I think the segues come very naturally, and it's nice using a DJ word, because it's like, you know, it's like being a mix master in a certain sense. But I think it's the most natural thing in the world. I think most of us are taught to write on naturally. I was, with the sense that, well, you know, writing about what your boyfriend said to you is very different than writing about Che Guevara, which is very different than theorizing pain and empathy and numbness, which is very different than understanding your own life story. Like, your life story has nothing to do with leprosy colonies in South America in the 1940s, except that that's how we actually understand. That's how we. And if you look at how your own mind works, if you follow the stream of consciousness, as a few writers like Virginia Woolf do so beautifully, you know, or you just look at a conversation you have with your friend, your best friend comes and sits next to you at the bar and talks about what happened to her yesterday and how she feels about it and what reminds her of and what, whether she's going to the big demonstration and how the world gets changed. And, you know, we move seamlessly in conversation and thought that way all the time. And in a sense, I'm just trying to replicate that in writing, because the world is connected up by those associative lateral moves, and not, I think of it as kind of the meandering paths through which you really see the landscape and discover, you know, and can get in close and pick the mushrooms or, you know, observe the details. And the narratives we're supposed to tell, if you're trained in that classical composition manner, are more like super highways raised up above the landscape, going in this very fast linear fashion that has its uses but leaves so much out.
It does seem, though, that even in this sort of meandering structure that you build, there is sort of a backbone. And I think you mentioned before that there was a very symmetrical structure to the book as well. And so is there a way in which there's you work with both the idea of having a structure and also being able to be loose sort of within that structure?
This book is very much a celebration of books, both in talking about the way being a writer brought people into my life, changed my life, and that amazing experience that most young people who are bookish or writers have of being, you withdraw into books as a kind of solitude. And the thing for me is, and then I wrote books, and that was also very solitary. And then people started arriving that the books brought to me, and I say it's as though I ran into the woods to hide, and came out the other end, the other side of the woods, where all these people came and joined me in the woods. Yeah. Really wonderful people. So the book is a celebration of books, and it's also playing with the form of the book. I'm amused that this isn't going to work so well on ebooks, but, you know, there's a symmetry that we talked about, which is modeled, and the sense of stories within stories, inspired very much by the Arabian Nights, Frankenstein, which is a story within a story, and those other kinds of containers of stories. And of course it has the 14th chapter running as a single thread all the way across the entire narrative, the 14th chapter that connects the whole book together, in this book that's full of metaphors of threads and ties and, you know, the blood lineage that's literally seen as a thread. And in Buddhism, the word sutra for a Buddhist teaching that comes from the same root as the word suture, to sew something together. Mm. You know, there's all these threads in the book. And yeah, so the formal structure and the associative travel felt like they went together very organically. Although I can see one looks very informal and the other looks very formal, but they might be doing the same thing, which is to kind of build by connecting and containing and opening into.
Another part of the book that was really compelling to me was this idea that you put forth that some stories are not good, or some stories you have to let go of. Storytelling is celebrated, but it's also, especially with your, when you're talking about your mother, you know, there's this idea that, you know, some stories it's great to sort of stop having them sort of control you. So can you talk a little bit more about that?
Exactly. It's really interesting. This book is very much about something I'm interested in both the big political arena and in small personal arenas. And the book's opening line is, "What's your story?" And we're all made out of stories, and we often say that as though isn't that magical and wonderful. But if you're made out of stories about racial or gender inferiority, about the doom because of your formative experience, about the limits placed on you, etc. You know, stories can be terrible curses. You know, that it's all your fault, I'm unhappy, etc. We have, you know, stories can be your salvation or they can be your damnation. And something I'm so interested in, I've learned from Buddhist practitioners, from reading, from people looking at the way metaphors structure our politics and realities, is being conscious of the stories, seeing what happens if the stories stop a little bit, and the stories we're running all the time, they kind of chatter in our brains, and maybe abandoning stories about, you know, how everything sucks and how I have no options and how nobody loves me, and those crappy stories we all tell all the time.
Mm-hmm.
The really interesting thing that's at the core of this book is that my mother was seething with rage at me most of my life, and it had very little to do with who I was and what I did. It came from categorical stories about what a mother is, what a daughter is, what a woman is, what beauty is, from the deep way the world is structured that so many of us inherit, that what I call the capitalism of the heart, the sense that the more you have, the less I have, so your abundance is my deprivation, and your deprivation would be my abundance. But yeah, and the really what happens in the center of this narrative is my mother begins to forget things and is transformed by that, and I'm not a celebrant of Alzheimer's. It's overall a terrible disease that I wish never happened to anybody. But quite suddenly, my mother lost all her stories about me and began to adore me. And for a writer, it's amazing to see what burdened stories can be and what's there after the stories. You know, I'd walk into a room and she'd light up.
Mm-hmm.
And she really seemed to enjoy, and it wasn't just like, oh, this makes life easier for me. She really seemed to enter this luminous passage of her life where, because she wasn't burdened with bitterness about the past or anxiety about the future, or this kind of anxiety, this narrative anxiety that had really kind of enclosed her, been, if not quite a straitjacket, a kind of confining garment she'd always worn. She was naked in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
And encountered everything directly. Every piece of cake was the most delicious piece of cake. Every flower was the most beautiful flower. She enjoyed things immensely, including me. And so this is a book about losing stories. Mm-hmm. You not only her losing them through a brain disease, but also what happens when you give up on a story, when you change the story, when you see something differently, because you're able to become conscious enough to see that the story doesn't work, or to learn how to tell it another way.
I really like the phrase narrative anxiety. I think that
well,
explains
so.
A lot of sort of our modern anxieties in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Well, we spent most of what we're anxious about is not what's actually happening. It's about what we think might happen, or, you know, it's this kind of chatter we run and about what has happened or might happen, or how somebody might respond to something that, you know, and it's this kind of busyness we have, and the stillness when it all stops is as beautiful as the stillness after a storm. One of the most difficult things for a writer to write is silence, but I think this is a book in praise of that peace after the storm and some of that silence of being without stories, or those moments suddenly when the story falls apart and you go look at before you enter into another story, that space between stories.
Can you say a little bit about the title, The Faraway Nearby? I think you sort of explain it in the book, but it does seem like a touchstone in a lot of ways about, sort of thematically.
Absolutely. It's a gift I gave myself from Georgia O'Keeffe, who was a great modernist painter, Anna's always been one of the women whose lives I admired. She was so independent, lived in the New Mexico desert where I spend a lot of time but don't live. And she mostly gave her paintings modernist titles that were simple descriptions of color or place or something like that, or subject. And she has this one painting that's fabulous of a mini-antlered antelope skull hovering in the foreground of a fabulous New Mexico sky and land, and it's called The Faraway Nearby. And that title came from letters she would write to close friends who were far away. And she would sometimes sign them from the faraway nearby. And it's such a beautiful phrase. It was so perfect for this book that goes to, lives through other people's stories, addresses these very intimate and personal things about illness and the body and mothers and friendship by going as far away as I could to Iceland, by finding stories of people I'd never meet, a cannibal in the Arctic, Che Guevara in the leprosy colonies, but always as a way of coming in deeper to this personal stuff, never as just escapism. And I actually tried to find paraphrases and other versions, because I've never used, I've always made up my titles from scratch.
Mm.
But it was just such a beautiful accomplishment of everything I wanted the book to do that, it stayed.
Mm. It actually, it's funny that you said that it's different from your other titles, because it does remind me a little bit of A Paradise Built in Hell, just because there's that paradox sort of at the center of that title, and it does something so instantly in terms of changing your understanding by putting, paradise and hell together. And in the same way, I think, far away and nearby do the same thing.
And the same with The Field Guide to Getting Lost, whatever the hell that is,
right.
Other than the title of a book of mine.
Yeah.
And then Hope in the Dark, my That's book, true. Which was sometimes described as Hope in Dark Times or something
right.
predictable like that. But it's really about hope coming out of the darkness of uncertainty, of not knowing what's going to happen next,
right.
and in praise of darkness.
So, it does seem, do you think that sort of paradox is something that you're drawn to in terms of a way of thinking?
Yeah. And writing? Absolutely, yeah. Very much so. With the sense that the world is more mysterious, beautiful, and complex than the versions we're usually given, and I want to enter into that complexity and not iron out those contradictions or paradoxes, but just to fully appreciate them. There's a sense we're often given that you have to choose one side of a contradiction or iron out a paradox, so it no longer is that. But that's a form of reduction, and I'm happy to try to just expand to encompass that we all contain paradoxes, contradictions, and mysteries. And a lot of my work is in praise of those things, thus at least four paradoxical titles.
That's true. I didn't even notice the other two that you mentioned. Do you think that this type of writing, you have mentioned in the past different mentors or inspirations, other writers that do this type of writing, perhaps that defies categories. Do you think that what do you think about sort of the modern state of that type of writing? Or
there's so much writing going on right now that there's lots of things I can be grumpy about in the mainstream. But there's wonderful people at work. Are you asking me about particular influences?
Sure.
Yeah, and one big influence for this was Barry Lopez writing about terrible things that happened to him as a child. He wrote it in a beautiful essay called A Terrible Abundance of Water about a dozen years ago. And I think he'd waited because he needed to wait to talk about that, but also because at the point at which he wrote it, you could see that here's a man who'd had an extraordinary life and tremendous success, etc., that he wasn't just a victim. And there was an enormous generosity in how he told it, with the sense that everybody suffers, and your suffering doesn't make you exceptional. Maybe the way you respond to it might, what you do with it. And so that influenced me. Buddhism did, with a sense that's very different than the therapy culture I'm snarky about, even though therapists can be wonderful. But there's often a sense in the States that nobody should suffer. Suffering is this terrible thing. If you suffered, you've been deprived and your life isn't as good as it should be.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Buddhism is suffering's kind of a given that arises from attachment. It's sort of the human condition. The question isn't about how can you get all numb and insulated against it and protected and safe? Because that doesn't really exist except as a life that's incredibly boring and insulated.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, what are you going to do about suffering? How are you going to learn? You know, this isn't a particularly Buddhist term, but a certain kind of gallantry or debonairness about it. How are you going to learn to wear your suffering lightly? I think part of how you do it is seeing how ubiquitous this is, how much this really is the human condition. And, you know, that's why writing a book that's partly about my own tribulations and illness, a difficult parent, some other crises, I reached out to these other stories of people in these kind of crucial moments, coming to, you know, coping with their own lives. And, you know, people, you know, other people keep you company. Being alone is often the worst of suffering, which is why stories about other people's suffering give us great comfort. I think it's why we even like melancholy ballads and pop songs and things. And so it's really about telling other people's stories as well. And now I've done exactly what we're talking about. I've sort of free associated away from writers who influence me. You know, I'm always influenced by Eduardo Galeano and Isaac Dinesen, as I said. They have a sense of kind of beautiful and fabulous things, even when they're about very tough stuff, even when Galeano's talking about politics and torture and things like that. And but also by Virginia Woolf, who has that incredible associative gift to move. And some writing is made out of solids. Hers is always entirely fluid and musical like water. So she's always with me as a writer. And, you know, I could go on and on, but
it's interesting that you talk about a writer like Barry Lopez, and I think that I might have read somewhere just about your own ideas about political engagement in writing, and whether to handle something like that perhaps more directly versus in a kind of indirect way. It seems like in this book, for instance, the sort of call towards political engagement comes sort of to me sneakily in this chapter about Che Guevara, which I thought was incredible. And do you still contend with that idea of sort of how direct do I engage with this, with these political issues of the day, versus how much do I stand back and think sort of more meditatively about it?
You know, I always cheat by doing both, and this is an introspective book that travels through fables and stories from long ago and far away and things like that. And you know, when I was writing, the events I was living through, as I said, were happening while I was writing A Paradise Built in Hell. You know, I cheat by doing both this very introspective stuff and the work that deals very much with the politics of our time, and by being an activist more directly with Occupy, with climate change and things like that. You know, and for me, that just feels like a rounded life as a writer, as a citizen, as a human being. You know, I don't want to choose either or. But I also think that there's a great feminist axiom, I think, from the 70s, that the personal is the political. And, you know, how gender unfolds in how women treat each other, as well as how men treat women, and men treat men, of course, and we won't even get into all other permutations of gender, is deeply political. You know, and that's one of the things that's present in this book. And I think teaching us that we're not connected, you know, to fight a war, first you have to convince people that you have nothing in common with, say, the people of Iraq, and you have to make children being dismembered by shells invisible, and you know, these questions of numbness, of whose story we hear, of where we draw the boundaries of our empathy or who we reach out to, have enormous repercussions politically. And it's often seen as this kind of burden, I'm going to shoulder the burden of caring. But I think it makes your world bigger in ways that can be really moving. At the very worst moment of all this, there was that tremendous uprising of the Buddhist monks in a Burma that was still a military dictatorship. It's loosened up a little bit since then. And I got very involved with that. And it was both a great respite from my own problems, a great perspective to see the selfless courage of these monks going out into the streets and you risking death for it, and the tremendous support they were receiving from non-monastic people and this, watching them, this kind of amazing red thread of monks, you know, like circulating through the streets, and a great community of compassionate and ethical people that I'm still connected to, partly through that. So you know, so you get something from these connections, even if they're for noble purposes. You know, and it's often seen as like, oh, you're selflessly noble and I hate you, or we're all really selfish, aren't we?
Right.
But doing these things is neither selfish nor unrewarding.
Yes.
And I think it's part of the self, the public self that I want, as part of the staking out, you know, the grander self I've been talking about in this interview, with the more variegated shoreline and more uncharted zones than the compact version of the self contained within our skin and our private lives we're often given.
Do you feel like, as I don't know if you're working on something now, but do you think that these are sort of the themes that you're following now, or is your writing changing in any way to address different themes than it used to?
I think it's been an ongoing thing. I've been trying to delineate the necessity of this larger public self, the self that needs meaning and purpose, and often engagement with civil society, with a sense of community, with a sense of, you know, maybe the fate of the earth and the larger world, meaningful work, has been something that, in what I've chosen to write about, and explicitly when I wrote about everybody's need for that in a paradise built in hell, it's been really central. So, you know, and it's present in earlier work of mine, but it's become more and more explicit and something I'll definitely continue writing about.
Mm. There's a lot of really interesting things on the internet of yours, lots of interviews as well as writing. But one of the sort of exciting things that I found was something about Beyoncé, who it was said that there was speculation that she named a baby after a passage in A Field Guide to Getting Lost. And so I thought maybe we could end by you explaining your connection to Beyoncé.
Ah, the tweet heard around the world. And yeah, I wish I had, my connection to Beyoncé. It's fun to say. I wish I was Cornel West so I could say my dear sister Beyoncé. And, you know, I love her work, and I really enjoy the way she's kind of carved her own path through the world of being a sexy female performer and a voice and refused genre and done very much her own thing. But nobody's more stunned than me when she tweeted a long passage about the color blue from A Field Guide to Getting Lost. And immediately all this other media started claiming that this was a clue to why she named her baby Blue. And I kind of believed, like, oh, you know, apparently she's named. And then I realized that she didn't say anything about her baby's name. She just tweeted the passage several months after the baby's birth.
Mm.
And everybody else ran around and overinterpreted. I'm honor bound as a journalist who believes in getting the story right and going to primary sources to say, I have no idea what she meant when she tweeted that passage, but it was extremely fun and flattering. And
I think it shows that your influence is widespread and that it has no bounds, really.
This is part of what The Far Away Nearby is about, is, you know, people in Iceland read something I wrote that brought them to connect to me in a way that brought them to Iceland, and now they're coming to the Bay Area. I'm actually on my way to see them in Iceland through this friendship that was forged partly through a book. But it's a little piece of evidence about how stories travel and how they connect up the world in ways you could never predict. You know, I was this kind of lonely misfit kid. Sometimes I wish I could write letters to the past and like tell her when she was 11 or 15 or something that she'd be tweeted by Beyoncé and, you know, speak in Dublin and be on the BBC and write lots of books and all these amazing things that were more than anybody ever let me expect in my life. And but yeah, Beyoncé. Fluffy high point.
Well, thank you so much for speaking with me today, Rebecca, and congratulations on your new book.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Granta Podcast, available for free download on iTunes, SoundCloud, and selected British Airways flights. To subscribe to Granta, please visit our website at granta.com.